Welcome back to Genetically Speaking. This is your host, Eli Robertson. Last week, we talked with Barbara Harrison. We're back with part two of our interview. We hope you enjoy. If you look at the history of healthcare, and including current history, not just past history, people from underrepresented minority backgrounds have had lower access to even standard medical care. And when you start to talk about precision health, and that would include genetic counseling, the gap between people that have access and don't has the potential to widen instead of narrowing and getting more people access to this sort of available approaches and technology. Do you have advice for genetic counselors on how to approach different cultural backgrounds and not just use one single standard that it's considered, this is how we do genetic counseling, so that you're more sensitive to people's backgrounds, and also how to help build trust from people who themselves may have had bad experiences in the healthcare system or have members of their family that have had bad experiences in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me tackle the first question about what genetic counselors can do differently, or kind of how we've approached kind of the philosophy behind our field, because I think you really hit on it. It's really appreciating that the philosophy in our field was developed by a small number of women who were privileged, right? And so that was the perspective that they came from when they developed this field and developed kind of how we approach genetic counseling. And so I think we're challenged now and have the ability and the opportunity to change that, to start to bring these different perspectives into our space, and really being able to listen and try to incorporate that and approach it more from a spirit of inclusion as opposed to assimilation, which I think we still get quite challenged with. I mean, I still see some conversations just amongst genetic counselors, amongst our listserv, that that kind of do the lip service of, we want people with different perspectives here, but really when that hits the ground, you don't really see that coming true. We get people who are trying to quiet people if they have certain, you know, feelings or perspectives, or trying to vocalize a particular viewpoint, and people kind of trying to shut them down or belittle what those views are. And so I think we have to be quite cognizant of that and allow people to voice that, and understand that we come from a very Western, you know, viewpoint, and that as we enter into these other spaces, and if we want the privilege of working with these marginalized communities, that we need to be very careful with our language. We need to be very aware of what our biases are, so that we can kind of put them to the side and really be able to see for ourselves when they are influencing the things that we're saying or the approach that we're giving. And then I think it's about working with those trusted individuals that are in those communities. So if it's a research project that you're trying to take on, or a new clinical space that you're trying to get into, to first reach out to the leaders in that community. And as you're even developing what that clinical service is going to look like, or developing what that research is going to, your research protocol is going to look like, that you truly have people at the table from the community giving you input that's valued and included. It's not to check the box to say, yeah, that person was there, but to really engage and change and make different that protocol. The protocol shouldn't look like what you came with, right? The protocol should change if you're getting truly incorporating the viewpoints of the community around you, that if you don't belong to, then they certainly should be having some different perspective on it. And so it does concern me sometimes when I see these community advisory boards, which are great in theory, but again, only if they're put in action the way that they're supposed to be. And so if it's still this small group of researchers or clinicians that is putting something together again in their echo chamber and then trying to present it to that person in the community, that has really, from the beginning, been the wrong approach. It's really about engaging that community from the front and really seeing what they need, which I think gets us to the second question that you asked, or maybe in the first question that you asked about how to engage these communities. And so I'm going to use sickle cell as an example, because I think this is a really good example of how we need to understand where the community is coming from before we kind of come in with what we think is best. So in sickle cell currently, there's a lot of activity around gene therapy. And people are feeling kind of good about themselves because we've acknowledged that sickle cell is a condition that's been ignored in the past, you know, has a horrendous history around sickle cell trait screening, around, you know, discrimination in the medical spaces, as far as how people with sickle cell has been treated. And so we're like, okay, well, we're going to do it right this time. There's this gene therapy. We're going to reach out to the sickle cell community and apply our knowledge about gene therapy to this community. And so I think on one level, that's very altruistic. I think it's good. I think it is a space that we need to be. However, it has to be understood that the community is, some people in the community will look at that with suspicion. Why are you coming to us now? This is a new, you know, kind of technology, and you're still figuring it out, and you're going to come to us to figure that out. And so that brings along this feeling of, okay, we're once again just being taken advantage of to try out this new thing that is going to be good for everybody. And are you really doing it for the good of our community? Are you doing it because sickle cell is a single gene disorder? It's pretty, you know, from a genetic therapy perspective, it's an ideal condition to do this on, or, you know, to try to test this technology out on, with, you know, all intentions that it's going to work well. And it has worked well. You know, we certainly are people out there who have been in clinical trials for gene therapy, and it is going quite well. But just understanding that without truly engaging the community in those conversations, that is what it looks like to the individual person out there with sickle cell who, you know, hasn't been formally or otherwise engaged in research. Now, so that's one challenge, is just understanding that that level of suspicion is going to be there. But the other thing that also has to be appreciated from researchers and clinicians in gene therapy is that there are vast amounts of people with sickle cell disease that do not even have access to care. And this goes back to what you're saying. This is a, you know, a marginalized community. There's numerous disparities in research funding, you know, as we know, that has trickled down to there being very few drugs that are specific for sickle cell disease, very, you know, by far not the level of development and treatments that we would expect, given how long we've known about sickle cell and a molecular, you know, basis for it, and strides that we've seen in other diseases that just has not happened in sickle cell. So you'll have people with sickle cell disease that said, yeah, a cure is great, gene therapy is great, I'm just trying to get to my doctor. I'm just trying to find an appropriate health provider who knows about my disease and knows how to take care of me. Because there is this extreme lack of adult hematologists that have dedicated themselves to knowing about sickle cell disease. There are not the number of comprehensive sickle cell centers that is anywhere even equivalent in terms of addressing the large population of people that have sickle cell, as opposed to, you know, there's like 30, let's say, for the 100,000 people that have sickle cell disease, there's only about 30 labeled comprehensive sickle cell centers, which is really a label people kind of put on themselves, because it's not, you know, any kind of federal mandate or regulations that say what that looks like. And yet we know with cystic fibrosis, with hemophilia. There's over 100, you know, centers for each of those conditions separately. Yet the number of individuals with it is about a third. It's about 30,000 as opposed to the 100,000 with sickle cell. So, you know, that's always already a great disparity. People aren't being able to get to care. You have, you know, 50 to 60% of individuals with sickle cell disease, depending on government insurance, which typically doesn't make getting access to specialty care relatively difficult. And so you just have great numbers of people with sickle cell out there that aren't even in care. And if you're not in care, you're not even going to have access to something like gene therapy. You can't even think about something like gene therapy. So although gene therapy is great and we need those efforts, we also at the same time need efforts to increase the level of care, of just medical care for individuals with sickle cell, because until they get into those clinics, they're not going to be able to get into those trials. And so I think that's a really, really good example of how we need to really be listening to the community and addressing that need. And then think about what, you know, how can we get to this next step of development in terms of something like gene therapy?
You had kind of mentioned this before. A lot of these careers have been traditionally open to people from privileged backgrounds only. And that has changed somewhat over the last 30, 40 years. It has gotten better. But a lot of people that we've talked to, when they're going into these spaces, they may be the only one that looks like them when they get there. But now you've gotten to be successful in your career. You've helped build these networks, and you've got lots of younger people who are coming in. What's it like now to be able to mentor people who maybe you wished you had someone that was like who you are now when you were first starting?
So that has been awesome. There's just no word for it. I tell people I would, even as a Black genetic counselor and being the only genetic counselor at my institution, I would go to our National Society of Genetic Counselor meetings every year. And I would kind of just try to soak up all the energy from the genetic counselors in general, and then soak up my energy from my Black genetic counselors, and then, you know, go back and try to have that last me for a year to, you know, so I got to the meeting the next year. Social media is great. The way that we have been able to network with each other, your LinkedIn, you know, even Twitter and Facebook and all of those, the way we've been able to take advantage of those in our professional spaces really provides this sense of community that is unparalleled and has provided the opportunity to provide that mentorship. And so I definitely consider it a privilege to be able to do that, you know, privilege and an honor, and absolutely wish that I had that as a student, you know, a genetic counseling student. What's unfortunate is because people are still the one of, you know, the one and only in their cohort in some schools, it amazes me that as I'm providing that mentorship, I'm still hearing the same stories of what I went through 20 years ago. And so to be able to be a voice in that moment is very powerful. I remember at some points during my training, like literally, like, I'm just walking out of here. This field is not for me. It's just too much going on. What I realize now were microaggressions that I was experiencing, side comments. And let me say that my cohort was very supportive in general. I mean, they're all very nice. No one say anything, you know, overtly bad to me or anything like that. But it was just little things like after class, they're all going to a bar or a pub to hang out. And I just don't feel comfortable there. You know, so that was kind of making me feel a little bit to the side. And again, it wasn't anything intentional. It's just those types of activities or those types of actions do start to build up over time. So in any case, and then, you know, whether it was an experience with the supervisor, you know, had statements made to me that I used slang, that I was too comfortable with patients, that I needed to, you know, show myself in a certain way that they weren't comfortable with just because it was different than how they did it. And so being able to support other students as they're going through that and really helping them to understand there are different ways to interact with patients, and that's really okay. And if you're able to make the patient feel comfortable, then that's the goal. And reinforcing that message, I think, is important. So being able to do that and providing that mentorship, it is certainly, like I said, a privilege, something that I do not take for granted.
During your journey, I think it's easy to say that it's hard whenever you're one of the first people that gets let into the space. And then, like you say, sometimes there's all these things that may get said, or maybe people don't even intend to other you, but you still feel othered. You finally get let in the door, and maybe the idea is we want you to assimilate into what we see everyone as the end goal, how they're supposed to act and behave. So that's something you deal with every day. And now you're caring for patients, you're mentoring people, you're doing lots of extra work that's not even your primary job, and doing all your day-to-day taking care of your own life. Genetic counseling in particular can have a high emotional toll, because sometimes you're having to deliver information that people don't want to hear. It's going to make them sad. And how do you go about trying to balance all of these different aspects of your life, and what kind of support systems have you built for yourself while you're going through all these different parts of your life?
Yes, I've told people that I think I've stayed at Howard so long, because I came here and didn't leave, because there were so many different things to do. So that's actually been a benefit. I have had the opportunity to see patients, to teach, to administer, you know, a genetic counseling program for many years, to be involved in research, to do outreach work, particularly in sickle cell through our Center for Sickle Cell Disease. And so all those things have allowed me respite from the others, I think, you know, especially that patient space. So I have certainly had many people in my cohort and, you know, around my age bracket who stayed in that clinical space for about 10 years and then, you know, really needed to do something else. And it's burnout, because it can be very emotionally taxing. So the benefit that I've had at Howard is that in the grand scheme of things, Howard is a relatively small hospital. So I have rarely been in a situation where I have just seen patients day in, day out, every hour, you know, kind of without a break. I've always kind of had patients spread out throughout the week. And so I've been able to have that interaction, which is why I got into genetic counseling. It was, you know, definitely feeds my motivation to be in this field. But it hasn't been overdone. And so even though at times I do feel overwhelmed because it may get to be more than others, definitely kind of ebbs and flows. In the grand scheme of it and looking at it overall, I've been able to balance that time that I have with patients to, okay, today I'm not going to have to deal with patients. Today I'm just going to teach today. Or I get to spend all this great time working with people in the sickle cell community, because we're planning this big sickle cell walk. And so, you know, that's kind of more of a fun thing. And it's just pulling on a different skill set of putting together an event like that. So I feel like my position at Howard already ingrained some of that variety and kind of protection around even my own kind of mental health and mental state. Not that I'll deal with a lot of, you know, same administrative headaches and things that other people deal with and, you know, those kind of frustrations. But at least it's been spread out in different areas. It hasn't been all been in the same area. And then over my time there, you know, I've raised a family, you know, been through a lot. And Howard as well has been always very supportive around that. If I can't get to work until 10 o'clock, I don't get to work till 10 o'clock unless, you know, I have a patient or something I need to do or a meeting. But being able to kind of control my own schedule has been quite valuable in me being able to balance the different aspects of what I do. And so I certainly encourage others as they get into these spaces and they want to look into these different projects and those kinds of things to definitely make sure that you protect your time and protect yourself. If it's not kind of automatically ingrained, as I feel like it's been very easy for me to navigate throughout my career at Howard. I know in other spaces, it's not like that. And you just have to be honest. You know, I've always kept patients first. If I'm in the middle of doing something with that sickle cell walk, but there's a patient who needs me, then I will definitely go and see that patient. Like, you definitely have to have those priorities in order. But within that, to allow yourself to not be so engaged in that workspace that you don't balance that out with something else. Because I will say, as a new graduate, I think many people as new graduates, you feel like you have to be there until, you know, 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock. And even though now I'm still there until 7 or 8 o'clock, at least I'm doing things that I want to do, things that I'm really engaged in. It's not like I'm just feeling like I'm doing grunt work and kind of wearing myself out. So I think it's important to find those other passions in your space. And if your passion is working with patients, well, just maybe do it in a different way or engage with a patient advocacy group or, you know, just something that's a little bit different than that day in, day out clinical encounter that really can wear on you.
I think the phrase diversity, equity, and inclusion is sometimes just a throwaway that's used by organizations to say, we've now said that we value everybody and the work's done. But when you step back and actually take a critical eye to look at the training of scientists and clinicians and the practice of medicine, it applies to all aspects. Like you've mentioned before, the training of people, attracting people to the career, giving them the space to exist as themselves so that they want to stay, and the flexibility of understanding that everybody's different. Understanding that these are very broad and complex problems that cover every aspect of science and medicine. What slice are you most passionate about trying to achieve change?
So I think I've landed myself maybe in two of those spaces. One, I would say, is the workforce space. I really think it's important that we find alternative paths into genetics careers. And not alternative to say that they shouldn't go to a master's program or shouldn't do a PhD in order to get that training, but kind of what happens before that. You know, traditionally, we've gone to undergrad institutions and, you know, pulled folks from there. But we know that people start thinking about their careers before undergrad. That's partly what drives them to go to, you know, to undergraduate education. So we need to be better at reaching out to high schools, just raising the awareness of things like genetic counseling from the beginning. One thing I kind of brag about my parents is when I was a junior in undergrad and I came to them with this idea that I wanted to be a genetic counselor, of course, they looked at me a little sideways because they were like, what is genetic counseling? And it's funny because even at our last, the National Society of Genetic Counselors meeting that we just had, we talked about our name, genetic counselor. And people are still, you know, you have that elevator pitch about what is genetic counseling to explain to folks. But I say that to say, when I went and told my parents this is what I wanted to do, I was able to explain it a little bit to go, you know, maybe a couple of weeks to convince them. But they were very supportive. They, you know, in the end, they didn't turn back and they did everything that they could to support me in that choice. But I can certainly understand, particularly as a parent now, that if, you know, my child came to me and said they wanted to do something that I wasn't quite sure was going to work out, wasn't quite sure was going to pay the bills and were they going to end up back in my house, my reaction might have been different. And so I think that's why we really need to work not just to raise awareness among students about, you know, or people looking for that career about genetic counseling, but really engage full communities, which I think then feeds into my next passion in this area, which is raising the awareness in the layperson community about genetics, genetic testing, genetic counseling, and doing that through things like family history, something that people understand. Do I think it's great that genetics has now been used in areas like heart disease and cancer? Because that makes it more palpable to people, makes it more tangible. And with that, I think we can use that as a board to say, okay, yeah, this might be great for you for your medical care, but there are people that do this every day. And maybe this is a career option for your children, if they come to you with this, it won't seem so foreign. And we know that this is the wave of the future. This is personalized medicine. And so we, you know, show that engagement and excitement around it and really get that message across. Then I think it will trickle down to, you know, to the younger generation. You know, I see it even when I'm seeing patients, and I would say about 30% of patients I see, I have to use an interpreter, mostly Spanish. But sometimes that child will be in the room. And so I'll be, you know, doing my thing and talking. And then at the end, you know, kind of look to that child and say, you know, well, what are you thinking of? Kind of engage them in that conversation. maybe that's someone who's interested in healthcare. I always encourage them, like, stay bilingual. This is such a valuable skill that you have. And it's just right there ingrained with you. Don't lose that. No matter what field you choose to go into, it's going to be a benefit. But definitely if you go into medicine or health or science or genetics, you know, it will be very helpful. We need to engage. So I think it's just finding, I really feel like these efforts around diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice is really about integrating it into everyday actions. It's not about it's being in this office and it's isolated in a silo, but it's really spread across the whole health enterprise. And creating, I think, pipeline programs are really important. Again, engaging those high schoolers, going to community colleges. Some people choose that because that's what they're able to do in that moment, but it's not that they don't have aspirations to do more. It's just that that's what's there. That's what's affordable. That's what's in their community, literally in their community. And so if we can reach out there, as well as teachers, science teachers, now we definitely need them teaching because education, I'm sure they would be, you know, kind of getting on me if I'm trying to take their teachers from them. But, you know, people need those. I think Jen and Kathleen itself is a great second career to bring those experiences with you into this space and then informing the things that we do, because genetic counseling and genetic testing spans that whole lifetime, right? It's not just something you do when you're pregnant or, you know, just in certain time frames. So I think having the value of people from various spaces in their lifetime journey is also another, you know, kind of value perspective to bring in. So I would say definitely that workforce, around those workforce issues, which therefore can engage the communities.
Barbara, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
Sure, no problem. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I'm Eli Robertson. Thanks for listening to this episode of Genetically Speaking. Join us again next week for another episode.